Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence has impressed me greatly is our first guest. His name is Ambassador Morse Tan. He served in the administration as America's ambassador at large for global criminal justice, drawing on his expertise in international criminal law as a professor, and now as the incoming dean, I'm very, very happy to report, of the Liberty University School of Law, starting in January. The ambassador is the author of North Korea, International Law, and the Dual Crises, Narrative and Constructive Engagement. It's a delight to say that I had the privilege of interviewing him for a new program that is rolling out today, as I talk about in my commentary. Issues Alive is the title. We call it The Big Picture, because that's what we're focused in on. And in specific focus in the course of my interview with Ambassador Tan was a piece of legislation known as H.R. 3446, now awaiting consideration by the House of Representatives. Its formal title is the Peace on the Korean Peninsula Act, and I'm delighted to have a chance to continue and drill down further with Ambassador Tan on that act and so much more. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's terrific to have you with us, sir.
It's great to be with you all here.
Congratulations on your new gig. I think it's a terrific university, and I know they will benefit greatly from your leadership there, as it has with our other friend, Dave Bratt, now the dean of the business school. I want to talk with you a little bit about North Korea, though, at the moment, and specifically your insights, having studied it closely over many years, as to the nature of the regime that we're talking about possibly making some sort of peace agreement with. Tell us, you know, both about how it treats its own people and what that ought to tell us about its reliability in dealing with ours.
Yes, it crushes its own people, so much so that I coined a new term to describe it, that this is a state that does not recognize or honor the rights of its people, and therefore it is a state of rightlessness. And so the people are crushed, not only in these concentration camps, which are like those of Mao, Hitler, and Stalin, but the whole country is one jail of a country, and it organizes the whole country based on perceived political loyalty to the Kims. They are falsely deified and treated as if they are deity, and it is the most unjust totalitarian state on the planet.
And just to put a bit of a fine point on that rightlessness, describe what life is like for the average North Korean. And I'm not talking about those in the gulag of North Korea. I'm talking about the people who are being oppressed, as you say. How does that manifest itself, especially if they have given any rise to suspicion as to their loyalty to the Kim dynasty?
Yeah, everything is impacted by the perceived political loyalty, whether it is their food allocation, which is usually minute, whether it is educational opportunities or work opportunities. It is all structured, whether it's housing allocation or clothing allocation. And they are basically slave labor to the Kims. And there is now in its third generation of this dynasty, Kim Jong-un, presently the supreme ruler. and they are pumped with propaganda all day long. They're not allowed to access other sources. And so there's a nationwide intranet, generally without access to the internet by the people. They are worked not in a calling of their own choosing or anything along these lines. Typically, they are peasants who are working to farm the land there, or to work in the mines, or to do menial, heavy, difficult labor. That is typically what is imposed upon them. The citizens in Pyongyang, the capital, are not allowed to cross the street without permission. They're not allowed to move freely within the country, much less outside of the country. And so it is a stifled, oppressed existence that they live day by day.
This is generally the case with these kinds of totalitarian systems. We'll be talking later in the program with an author of a very important book on the authoritarians. The Kims take in this big brother kind of systematic oppression, though, to a whole new level, it seems. As is evident from those who have fled the country, the defectors that are a source of, I guess, most of our information, basically, about the conditions there and the state of the people. You've mentioned that they're malnourished, and that includes even their military personnel, who, relatively speaking, are treated very well. I hear reports, I think you've talked about it on our program Issues Alive, if I'm not mistaken, the stunted growth of many of the North Korean military personnel, even, let alone the rest of the population. Talk a little bit about what we've learned from these defectors and what has been happening of late with respect to not only China, but South Korea's treatment.
So there is a wealth of information that has emerged from the defector testimony. It is extensive, and you can see common themes and patterns that emerge as they independently testify about what is going on. With respect to China, that is where most of the refugees flee to, because the northern border is easier to cross than the most militarized border in the world, the so-called demilitarized zone in between North and South Korea. And the Chinese Communist Party has a policy of hunting down and sending back, often to their death or to concentration camps, back to North Korea. And notwithstanding the fact they have ratified the Refugee Convention, they do not abide by it. And they refuse to recognize these people as refugees, even though they are. And at a minimum, they would be refugee surplus, as is called. They are refugees because if they are sent back, they would suffer the draconian punishments that are there. So in South Korea as well, there is a diminished treatment in terms of how well they're treated compared with before. There were a lot of benefits that were given to North Korean refugees, but many times they tend to be more marginalized. Even more so if they are trying to send true information back to North Korea or get involved with human rights and justice issues in regards to North Korea, in which case they are often blocked, even persecuted by the current administration in South Korea.
Now, this is all the more striking because we consider, of course, South Korea to be a critical ally in that part of the world and very much aligned with us in terms of our values. This is not so much the case, it seems, with the government of Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, for at least a few more months. Which brings me to the topic that we'll be discussing as we speak. It's in the future. As this program airs, it will have occurred earlier in the day. Ambassador Morse Tan, you'll be participating in a program where a new book is being rolled out, as well as this series of programs that we've done on Asia, and specifically this question of North Korea and the prospects that we might inadvertently see a well-intentioned but ultimately wrong-headed idea of how to deal with North Korea, namely a peace agreement formally ending the Korean War, that could go seriously wrong. So we're going to be doing all of that in this program today, and I just would invite you to sort of give our audience a taste of what you'll be saying there, specifically about this agreement, were it to happen, and how it might result in the hands of Moon Jae-in in a very dangerous new environment, possibly even a new Korean War.
Yes, indeed. So there was a armistice agreement, a ceasefire, which North Korea has violated numerous times. And they also enter into agreements for tactical gain. What they do is they precipitate a crisis, get to the table who they want to get. They negotiate benefits, they swallow those benefits, and then break the agreement. And this is a regime with the overarching aims of promoting positive sentiment towards them in South Korea to get the U.S. uninvolved in the peninsula and then ultimately to take over by force. That those have been the persistent overarching aims. The U.S. commitment to defend South Korea has been the largest deterrent from the reoccurrence of a full-scale Korean War. And so this would be akin to Neville Chamberlain saying that he has won peace in his time just before World War II erupts. This is very ironic because it would weaken, potentially eliminate the presence of American forces in South Korea, because Moon Jae-in would potentially be able to then say, oh, these U.S. forces aren't needed. We have peace now. And they could dismantle the UN command, which the U.S. has been the leader of throughout. And so if that happens, then it would actually increase the possibility of a full-blown Korean War more than accomplishing peace by a rather large margin. And so there's a great irony to it.
A great irony indeed, but one that could, in fact, be predictable, given what you've said about the character of this regime. And I just want to underscore it, because I think what you bring to this, Mr. Ambassador, both from your official duties in the Trump administration, with responsible for global criminal challenges like that posed by the North Korean government, and for that matter, its principal sponsor, the Chinese Communist Party, which, as we've talked about, I believe ought to be designated as a transnational criminal organization for its criminal activities, as frankly should the Korean regime in Pyongyang, North Korean regime in Pyongyang. But when you look at this sort of failure to learn from past experience, the hard series of false promises that the North Koreans have made, each of which has been ultimately reneged upon, and what we have done despite it to enter into yet more agreements, this would really seem to underscore the combination, particularly of the human rights record of the North Koreans and their failure to comply with any of their commitments. Given the stakes you've talked about, sir, I think it's just absolutely vital that this kind of legislation not be, advanced through the House of Representatives, signed into law.
Yes, it would be a real mistake. And, you know, if North Korea had actually taken steps to demonstrate its peaceful intentions, which it has not, it has done the reverse. It has resumed missile tests, which were stopped and quieted during the past administration. It is it is probably afraid that it will remain culpable for war crimes that have been committed, is already committing genocide against Christians, as well as those who are not completely of Korean descent. It is committing all manners of crimes against humanity as well. And so this is a criminal cult along the lines of what you had described and mentioned earlier, where they are committing all manners of crimes against their own people, as well as those outside of the North Korean regime as well. And so this is not a peaceful regime. It operates on the basis of force, and to try to come to this this pronouncement of peace would be a step of walking into a very dangerous fantasy land.
And legitimating the government of North Korea at the same time, and encouraging the worst proclivities of the government of South Korea, I have to say as well. All good reasons to be very leery of this approach. Mr. Ambassador, we have to leave it at that, I think, for the moment. I look forward to seeing you in real time here shortly, and to talking with you further about all of this as we watch whether Congress begins to take serious steps in this direction, or whether cooler heads prevail. And most especially, we get a grip on the character of the North Korean regime, and hopefully see in South Korea a new and more sensible, more reliable allied government in the post-election period next spring. Thank you for your time today, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for your service to our country, and congratulations again on the service you're about to assume and engage in at Liberty University's School of Law. Talk with you again soon, sir. Bill Walton is up next. We'll take stock with him on China, what it's doing to its own people and us as well, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and as is often the case, about this time each week, we have the chance of visiting with Bill Walton. He is a master of the universe, now recovering, I should say, from his time in Wall Street, where he was very successful there with Allied Capital Corporation. He is these days, most notably, the prime mover behind a terrific podcast television program called The Bill Walton Show. And what Bill is doing with that program, I think, is really quite extraordinary in terms of his interviews with thought leaders, entrepreneurs, business tycoons, and other influencers, providing deep insights into money, culture, and politics. He does this under the rubric of the Resolute Protector Foundation, which is producing such content and more. Bill, you are always welcome here, but particularly, as I understand, you've got some fresh insights for us on what is going on with the romance between your former colleagues on Wall Street and Communist China that is enabling so much of the threat to us. Talk a little bit about this chap, Ray Dalio, and his machinations to, well, obviously stay in the good graces of the Chinese Communist Party, but sort of avoid some of the appropriate criticism that is received for what seems to be his slavish devotion to doing business with the CCP.
Well, Frank, as we've talked about, these global hedge fund managers seem to see themselves as hovering above and superior to mere nation states. And Ray Dalio runs one of the largest hedge funds in the world, invested in about 42 countries. And his view about China or any other country is simply that if he can go in and make some money, he doesn't really care too much about the rest of the political landscape. And last week, maybe it was a week before last, he was on CNBC and was asked about how he felt about doing business in China with their terrible human rights record, you know, what they're doing with the Uyghurs, forced organ donations and on and on. And he said, well, you know, that's just the way China operates. And then he was asked about, what about the forced disappearance of, or the disappearance of certain people who are protesting or not aligned with the Chinese Communist Party? And he said, well, you know, Chinese Communist Party got a long China's got a long reputation of being authoritarian, and when people disappear, they're just acting like stern parents. Well, that was not well received, and he came out last week again appearing, saying he didn't mean to convey that human rights weren't important. I was just tempted to explain what a Chinese told me about how they did things. And the question you have to ask yourself is, why are we putting our money with these people if they float above really basic human concerns? And why are they supporting what's going on in China?
They're not alone, of course. We have, in addition to the financial sector, hedge fund types, lots of other people, the guys, of course, putting money into index funds and exchange-traded funds, mutual funds, pension plans, and so on, as sources for funding the sorts of things you're talking about, Bill. And it's, of course, not just the Chinese Communist Party's oppression of its own people that's being underwritten in this fashion. It is their ability and obvious intent to threaten people elsewhere around the world, including ours. And the thing that is so astounding about this is, as you euphemistically put it, it's not just that they're rising above the rest of the political landscape. They are betraying our country by so doing, it seems to me. And one of the things that we're hopeful to facilitate with conversations like this, among other things, including a Mad as Hell campaign, which I encourage people to look into at madashell.org, to get those whose money is being invested in this fashion to, you know, say no, not with our money any longer. Your thoughts on how important that is, given the kinds of damage that you're talking about being done with our money?
Well, for those of us that care about liberty and care about the basic limited constitutional government we have in the United States and the great freedoms we've historically enjoyed, although even in the United States, we're seeing those freedoms eroded and in some cases erased in the last several years, we're up against some stubborn realities. I think I mentioned to you the Chinese represents what the investment community sees as almost a $70 trillion investment pool of consumer savings that they would love to be part of investing. The Chinese Communist Party is welcoming U.S. firms in because they want help in innovating an incredibly primitive capital market there. We're also up against the stubborn reality of China is the second largest consumer market in the world after the United States, and is the largest market for consumer luxury goods in the world. And that's a function of the fact that the Chinese standard of living has risen dramatically in the last 20, 25 years. And when we think about dealing with the Chinese Communist Party and its human rights violations, a lot of the ordinary Chinese are pretty happy with what's been happening in China, so it's hard for us to get traction. And then you see a report this week that Apple essentially bribed the Chinese Communist Party with $275 million to invest in various initiatives that Beijing was pushing, and promised it used more components from Chinese suppliers, and it's going to sign deals with Chinese software firms, collaborating technology with Chinese universities, and it's not alone. I mean, it's you've got Nike, Coca-Cola; they're all lobbying Congress to not pass a bill that would oppose the use of forced labor of Uyghurs in China. And you don't think about this, but the province that the Uyghurs are being prosecuted in, Xinjiang, is a huge natural gas producer, and consequently great for the resins that produce plastics, and polysilicon which is used in Apple products or produced there using forced labor provided by the Uyghurs. And the interrelationships are stunning. And so I think our job, Frank, and we're doing it right now, is to just make people aware of how we're being sold out by these companies. You know, Apple's got a $3 trillion market cap. It's the most valuable company in the world. And when you look at those cute little stores with the nice kids in there, you ought to realize that that's really got a very sinister underpinning.
And this brings me to the genocide games, because there are, in addition to Apple and Nike, a number of other American companies, Airbnb comes to mind, that are pouring very substantial sums into the so-called Winter Olympics in Beijing in February. And Bill, what we are on notice about is that, well, history has a very powerful precedent for what happens when you see the so-called international community ignoring the nature of the regime that it entrusts to host Olympic Games, only to discover that the regime interprets that trust as legitimization and a flashing green light for the government in question to behave not only aggressively, but murderously so on an epic scale. In the case of the previous example, the Berlin Olympic Games in 1936.
Well, and Frank, let's look at what the Nazis were doing. The Nazis put Jews and other Eastern Europeans in concentration camps. And what are some of the things they did? They experimented on live human beings for medical purposes or just to be, you know, outright evil. And fast forward to where we are today in China, they have not ended. In fact, their steps seem to be stepping up the practice of forced organ harvesting. And it's all part of, well, I know that it's all part of, but it's interrelated with their crackdown on Falun Gong, which is really just sounds like a very lovely kind of spiritual religion, which gained popularity, had almost 100 million adherents in China in 1999. Since then, they've been cracking down. And if you're a believer in Falun Gong, you're also a target for forced organ harvesting. And so when you go,
but this brings us back, Bill, to our own responsibility, if I could just interject this, because Americans, medical practitioners and individual, you know, patients are part of the enabling of this organ harvesting operation becoming a cash crop, if I can use that expression, for this murderous Chinese Communist Party regime. People are going over there, they're getting livers, they're getting hearts, they're getting other organs, kidneys, on very short order compared to what frequently it is entailed if you need one and are relying on the, you know, U.S. system or European ones to provide you with those organs. So this is very much an example of a practice that is being enabled, being underwritten, being rewarded, made more profitable by the West, is it not?
Well, if we want to send a signal to the world that we care about freedom and we care about human rights, we ought not to be sending anyone into China to compete in an Olympic game, which legitimizes their regime. Just look what the party does to its own people. Beijing, as we know, is terrible smog because China provides most of its electricity from coal-fired power plants, and we've talked about it. They're building one on average a week still today, and they're shutting them down in the regions around Beijing. Why? Because they don't want the smoke from the plants to cloud the air in Beijing to ruin their photo op that they hope to get when the TV cameras come over to cover the Olympics. But they're willing to let their ordinary Chinese suffer through a very cold winter in Beijing. So they don't, you know, they don't care about us and they don't care about their own people.
We are, it seems, at the cusp of having this so-called Build Back Better huge spending bill approved by the House of Representatives last week and now awaiting Senate action, possibly favorable action. Tell us what's going on that front, Bill, and is there any hope that this, well, it can only be fuel on the fire of inflation, as well as perhaps the end of, you know, our constitution and free market capitalist system, if the Build Back Better types have their way. Will they succeed in getting this through the Senate, do you think?
Well, the egregious thing about what the Biden administration is doing and what Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are doing on the Hill is that they are trying to pass the most radical social engineering, big government socialist program in history, and they're doing it with razor-thin margins. I think Nancy's got about 4 or 5 vote margin in the House, and in the Senate, it's a 50-50 number, and the tying vote is our vice president, and we all know about her, Ms. Kamala Harris. So that means that if they need every single Democrat senator to vote for this bill, and the Joe Manchin, which has made a career out of being the swing vote on things like this, has been hanging in the balance, and just this week, at the urging of the Republicans, the Senate or the Congressional Budget Office scored Build Back Better. And Democrats have been claiming that this has been paid for through various taxes and fees and other and having 80,000 IRS agents provided for in the bill, being more aggressive about collecting taxes from Americans. Well, it turns out that's not true. It's not paid for. And it's at least to the tune of $3 trillion, it's not paid for. And as I've talked about before, our national debt to our GDP is at historic highs. It's higher now than it was during World War II. And so this is just more adding to our deficit. And Joe Manchin cares. And the people of West Virginia care. And Joe would like to have a viable political career. So this is very good news if we can keep him focused and give him an excuse to not vote for the bill. If he doesn't vote for it, it doesn't pass. And as I told you, our mission here is to kill the bill, not edit it, not adjust it, kill it.
Well, this is a really high-stakes poker, for sure. And I think that to the extent that we're watching some measure of honesty now being injected into this debate about the bill, and most especially this idea that the techniques that were used to claim, however fraudulently, that the bill was paid for by saying that the new entitlement programs that it's going to set up will somehow disappear in a year or two or whatever the, you know, sunset might be. This is, again, a bait and switch. No entitlement program ever goes away as a practical matter. So hopefully the CBO numbers are reasonably accurate, and hopefully that they will be taken seriously by, I would like to think, not just Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, who's made similar noises from time to time, but others measure of responsibility in the Senate. Go ahead.
Well, to tie a loop around this a bit, you know, the Green New Deal is an integral part of this Build Back Better. And the Green New Deal would, in trying to get us to zero carbon emissions, essentially moves our whole energy dependence over to China, because if you depend on wind and solar, you're essentially saying you're going to buy all the subcomponents or components of that from China. And of course, people are overlooking, if we did go to all wind and solar, it would require about 1/3 to 1/2 of the surface area of the United States to put up all those windmills and solar panels.
Aside from that, I mean, what's wrong with it?
So that's in the bill. So the longer we can push this out, and it looks like we're going to push it into next year, the more people know what's in it, the less likely it is they can pass this thing. And Americans don't want this.
We will be watching it closely, Bill, with your help, not least. And I thank you very much for addressing the latest developments today and and for all of the work that you do at the Bill Walton Show and beyond. Keep it up, my friend. We'll talk with you again next week, I hope, before Christmas. Thank you very much for joining us today. Next up, we will speak with Jonathan Emord about the authoritarians at work, not just in the Chinese Communist Party, but here at home as well. Stay tuned for that and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome for the first time, I believe, to these microphones to Jonathan Emord. He is a constitutional and administrative law attorney who has practiced since 1985. He is a former vice president of the Cato Institute, but perhaps most importantly for the present purpose, he is the author of an important book entitled The Authoritarians. He has dived deeply into this subject and its various implications, both for our present civil society and, well, more to the point, our freedoms. And it's a delight to have him with us to talk about all of that and more. He also is the author of a more comedic treatment, How Biden Stole Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa, too. We might touch on that as well. But first, let me welcome Jonathan. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on this important discussion that I think you're fostering with the authoritarians. And I want to get into that subject with you now.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
Authoritarianism is a term that might bear defining because other terms are used rather more frequently to describe some of its practitioners, socialists, communists, Marxists, the left, the radical left. What do you mean by the term, and is it all of the above?
It includes all of those things. It is whenever an advocate in government or outside favors deprivation of individual liberty to achieve collectivist ends.
And this is a phenomenon that has been operating in the world for quite some time. In fact, interestingly, you talk about a certain tradition of it in our own government. Talk a little bit about that history, Jonathan, and then we'll talk about its manifestations in our own time.
So what we see in our own time, these movements to censor information and to deprive people of rights to advance a collectivist agenda, socialism, is many people think that it's new, but it's actually very old in our country, and it has grown prolifically inside the administrative state, both on the federal and state levels. I discovered that firsthand when I came to Washington in 85 with the Reagan administration, when we were really frustrated beyond words to see career bureaucrats defeating all efforts to protect individual rights and expand the private sector at the expense of the government. But what we find and what I document in the authoritarians in a copious manner is that this movement towards collectivism first arose in the United States in the antebellum South in the 1830s when fire eaters in reaction to abolitionists were embarrassed that their adherence to the Declaration of Independence, particularly the second paragraph of the Declaration, all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that conflicted with their strident defense of slavery, and they were claimed by the abolitionists to both be enemies of this essential characteristic of liberty and our republic, and also betrayers of the legacy of Thomas Jefferson, and then also that they were anti-Christian because of the abhorrent institution of slavery. Reacting to this, they could no longer find a way to justify support for the republic and for this notion in the second paragraph of individual liberty. And so they cleaved to a new doctrine, which worked rather well, which was that of Friedrich Hegel. Hegel was the teacher of Karl Marx and was the founder of the notion of collectivism in a political sense. And he was a defender of the institution of slavery as part of the historic dialectic that later became adopted by Marx. So they adopted collectivism, and they said that the institution of slavery was good for slaves because it associated them with a superior race and enabled them to work at the level that they were capable of, which was, they said, the lowest level. They called it the lowest level, and they said that society could only advance if these menial tasks were performed by those appropriate for it, while others, whites, would progress on their backs, basically.
This is so fascinating, Jonathan, because what we are now, of course, being subjected to interminably by collectivists, people of the left, radicals, Marxists, what have you, is the idea that those who stand for, well, the Constitution of the United States, freedom, and you know, that second item in the Declaration and all the rest, are the racists in our country. In fact, systemically racist, indeed. What you've just described is a paean, really, a justification, an embrace of racism by the people who were the progenitors of this authoritarian, you know, enterprise, however it's defined and by whomever it's practiced.
Yes, and this notion that racism cures racism, which is really the mantra of BLM and Antifa and the 1619 Project, is really just a fraud, because what they're really trying to do is to create a bifurcation in society based on race, where people are at each other's throats. That's the means by which you can achieve revolution. If you can't have the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie, because we have such a upwardly mobile society and people won't accept that direct socialism and Marxism, they instead are able to play upon people's sympathies against racism and use that as a bugaboo for bringing about a socialist or communist revolution. And
it is basically, as has been pointed out by a number of our guests over these past few months in particular, Jonathan, the Maoist class warfare strategy mutated to play to this idea that America may not have classes so much as it's got this racial legacy and systemic character that is the fault line that can be, as you say, exploited by the authoritarians to take down a constitution that is a bulwark against their ambitions. No.
Yes, and this notion of systemic racism is utter rot. It is a perverted view of American society. We have achieved more in eliminating race as a factor in people's decision making than any other society on earth. And in point of fact, they rewrite history, BLM, 1619 Project, Antifa, falsely. So, for example, it comes as quite a surprise to many people, and I document this in The Authoritarians, that during the 1830s and forward, a significant number of ex-slaves became slave owners themselves. So you have blacks owning slaves.
No,
in fact,
kidding.
In Louisiana, you have the largest number of slaves held by a slave owner, held by a person who was black. And in addition, you have roughly 3,000 blacks owning slaves, more than 10 slaves each in America in the by the 1860s. So there is this.
That's a forgotten piece of our history for sure, and I commend you for your research.
And you have those horrors of slavery. I mean, in addition, what's quite not mentioned by 1619, here in 1619, there were around Easter time in 1619, 20 black slaves arrived at the Jamestown colony. What they don't tell you was that 4 months before that time, from the Bridewell area of London, 100 white slaves arrived in the Jamestown colony, and they were penal slaves brought there. They were vagrants, and they were exported at with the blessing of the crown to America, to the Jamestown colony. After the 20 blacks arrived in 1619, for a number of years, the vast majority, overwhelming majority of slaves brought into Jamestown were white, not black. And in fact, there were many white slaves all the way up to the time of the Emancipation Proclamation. There were thousands of white slaves in America. Now, it's true that there were 4 million black slaves, but the point is that the institution of slavery wrought evil upon all races, and that's true worldwide.
Jonathan Immord is our guest, and I want to just say, this is riveting and it's so contrary to the narrative that we're being force-fed by the groups that you've mentioned, in particular, the 1619 Project, Black Lives Matter, the organization, Antifa, and their fellow travelers, endorsers, apologists, amplifiers in the media, on Capitol Hill, in the Biden administration, not least. We're talking about Jonathan's book, The Authoritarians. Its subtitle is very important. Let me convey that. Their assault on individual liberty, the Constitution, and free enterprise from the 19th century to the present. Let me turn to the present, if I can, Jonathan, because it's not every day that people directly couple Antifa and Black Lives Matter, to say nothing of the 1619 Project. You've done so quite deliberately, obviously, and on the basis of your research. Talk a little bit about what it is that actually justifies lumping them together. Authoritarianism is obviously a shared agenda, a doctrine, an ideology, if you will. But in terms of their goals, in terms of their, well, even their practices, I guess one might say, is that coupling justified in your view?
Absolutely. When you look at their self-avowed Marxists, when you take the heads of the BLM organization, one example famously is Patrice Cullors. She was rather quick to admit that they are Marxists and that their movement
trained
is
Marxist.
A Marxist movement. Yes. And likewise, people in Antifa are very quick to mention that they are Marxists. In Europe, they've been around for a long time. And their movement is aimed at destroying free enterprise, destroying government. And so it's no mistake that they actually foment violence against government entities around the United States with violent attacks, and then in addition do so also even against religion. One of the things I point out in the book, which has not been covered virtually at all by the mainstream media, are the systemic acts of destruction of churches all over the United States and worshiping bodies. That's because Marxists, of course, are atheists, and they despise the institutions that have power, including those of the church, because they are competing sources of power to what they wish to achieve, which is this unified totalitarianism in Marxism, a communist revolution. That's what we're really talking about. These people are communists. They want to overthrow our systems of government. They have allies in the administrative state and have all the way back to the progressive era.
Jonathan, but let me ask you specifically on this business about shutting down the churches, because, of course, this has been a very prominent feature of what has been done under the pretext that COVID, the pandemic, trying to control its spread, required the closure of churches across America, and in some cases for quite protracted periods of time. Is that an accident, or are you suggesting that this is a deliberate reflection of an enforcement of the authoritarian agenda?
It is very much a movement of the authoritarian movement inside the government. It is very much a conscious decision to deprive people of rights. It follows along Rahm Emanuel's famous quote that one ought never allow a crisis to go to waste. This is, you have options, of course. You need not close a church or deprive people of their opportunity to gather for worship. You can, of course, inform them of risks and have them take whatever reasonable measures they think are necessary. And you can do that very well. So information is the antidote quite frequently to risks that are perceived. And most churches have had virtual attendance as an option and so forth. And this is because they recognize that they want to protect their parishioners, and that's a natural thing for people to want to protect themselves and for churches to want to protect their parishioners. But it's an utter disdain and hatred for religion that leads you to an authoritarian decision to shut it down, just as it is when you do so in the schools. But it gives you extraordinary power, and it makes people afraid, and they are then beholden to the government for more assistance, and you end up making people dependents and more slovenly in their adherence to one-size-fits-all mandates, which are really ruinous of liberty. So if you believed in the Constitution and you believed in individual liberty, you would recognize that civil rights are not suspended in the midst of a crisis. And in fact, in our history, civil rights have been the subject of the greatest decisions in favor of defense of liberty, precisely when government has presumed to take those rights away. And yet, and we see that again with the federal court decisions, five decisions holding an unconstitutional or in violation of statutory law, the mandates from the Biden administration.
Jonathan, we're almost out of time, and I just want to get to the sort of the money piece of this. I appreciate so much what you've laid out as both the history, the precedent, and the practice in this time. I want to look forward. Are you among those, as am I, who are deeply concerned that given what has been allowed to happen to our freedoms, to our Constitution, in the course of the past year or two specifically, that we are going to find ourselves confronting an even more draconian application of authoritarianism, perhaps akin to what another advanced democracy like Australia is experiencing at the moment?
I would certainly hope not. I think that all of the trend lines for government go in that direction, but I'm buoyed by the election in Virginia, gubernatorial election in Virginia, and by popular reaction. I think people have had it with mandates. I think people, even those who believe that vaccination is a good thing, still think that others ought not be compelled in their right. So I think the mystic chords of memory, as Abraham Lincoln referred to them, are once again being played. And we're hearing those resounding voices in favor of liberty, and we're cleaving to them. And I think that's our salvation.
Yeah, praise
so
God.
So in the 2022
From your
election,
lips to God's think, ears, as they say.
Yeah, Jonathan, I think a counter-revolution is underway.
Well, I hope so. And obviously, the nonviolent sense, it's needed. And if it isn't, we will find ourselves, I'm afraid, under the jackboot of these authoritarians, as the Australians have been. And others are seemingly following suit as well. Thank you for these warnings. The book is The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. Its author is Jonathan Amor. I hope you'll come back to us further and longer conversation about all of this, Jonathan. This is most vital and deeply appreciated. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton about our financial circumstances and whether the authoritarians are at work there as well.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.